To my right is the Honorable Nancy Lichtenstein, and to my left is the Honorable Sean Conley. We constitute Division 7 for oral arguments today. This is our one case on the 230 docket. It's in Re Marriage of Siegfried. I see that both counsel are seated. I would ask both counsel if they have received our one-page summary of our procedures here.
I have. Okay.
And does either counsel have questions about those procedures?
No. Okay.
Very good. I would last ask that if anyone has a pager or other device that might go off during the counsel's arguments, please turn it off or put it on silent, because we don't want to interrupt counsel. That being said, Mr. Zweibel.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. My name is Michael Zweibel. I represent the appellant in this matter, Rick Siegfried. This is a dissolution of marriage action. We've raised issues concerning both permanent orders and the contempt hearing that occurred as a result of those permanent orders. This case already was up once, was remanded by a different division of this court, and our issues regarding permanent orders arise from the order that the court below issued on remand. With regard to the permanent orders, and of course we've raised a number of issues, and I'm happy to address any issue that the court thinks is pressing, but I'd like to start with the permanent orders. And with regard to that, there are two issues. Whether Mr. Siegfried, the husband, received money for repairs and remodeling of a marital property and dissipated those funds. In other words, whether the repairs actually occurred, and secondly, whether the court correctly valued the property, the marital property at issue, the North 3rd Street property. One of the main problems in the court's resolution of these two issues is that the court reached contradictory findings with regard to the issues. On the one hand, the court found that the money received by Mr. Siegfried was not used for repairs, that no repairs were made, and that the funds were dissipated. On the other hand, the court found that the value of the property was increased in the amount of the repairs. And the value of the property can only increase in the amount of the repairs if the repairs were in fact made. And so on the one hand, we have a finding that the repairs were made for one issue, and for another issue, we have a finding that the repairs were not made. An order based on contradictory findings simply can't stand. It's a fundamental problem if you don't know what facts the court actually is finding.
Mr. Zweibel, just for a sake of clarification,
sure.
The court was not necessarily finding that no repairs were made, but was finding at least not in the amount of $204,000?
Well, and I saw that language, and I know that language was pointed out in the appellee's brief. The problem we've got is that the court gave Mr. Siegfried zero credit for the repairs. If the court found that some repairs were made, that means that necessarily some of that $204,000 was not dissipated. And yet the court found that the entire $204,000 was dissipated. And so is there an issue as to how much of the money was actually used for repairs? There may be. There may be another remand in the future in this case. But the problem is the court essentially made the finding that there was nothing. And actually, that brings me to the issue of repairs, and I guess I'll just jump right there. I was going to do value first, but I'll jump right to repairs. I think this is one of those rare cases where the court's factual findings are clearly erroneous. I mean, apart from the fact that these are contradictory, and I think that is by itself a reason for reversal. But apart from that, in this case, everybody agreed that some repairs were made. Everybody, including the wife. Everybody agreed. The wife testified that that the husband had installed a new heating system. She, you can tell from the transcript, she was a little chagrined at it. She thought maybe it was too expensive. Oh, he had to go and install a new forced air heating system or something. She said that and I've cited the portions in the brief from the record. She agreed new bathroom tile was installed. She agreed that new flooring was installed. She agreed that the now that's the repairs she agreed had been made. She said that in addition, the property was in disrepair. The windows had to be replaced, among other things. The carpeting had to be replaced. She estimated just the windows and the carpeting at $20,000 to $30,000. She herself didn't verify that those were made, as with the other repairs, but she verified that at least the floor, the tile, and the heating system was done. Richard Patterman came in. He was an expert in remodeling and repair. Although his testimony was somewhat circumscribed by the trial court, he made personal observations of the property and personally verified that the remodeling, which has been described in the testimony, had in fact occurred. So the court can completely discount husband's testimony. The court can say, this guy's a liar, I don't believe a word he says, but everybody else came in and said repairs were made too. There's not a shred of evidence that the repairs weren't made. Everybody agreed they were.
Mr. Swibell, if you could indulge me in this question for a moment, please. Let's assume for the purposes of argument that the trial court was saying something other than he made no repairs, despite the fact that she said that. What if the statement was actually, he did not satisfy me what the value of those repairs was? And I guess that leads me to the next question. Who has the burden of proof of establishing the value of the repairs?
That's an interesting question. I mean, I think that, first of all, I think the husband did. Well, let me answer the exact
sure.
question that was asked.
Sure.
I think the case was pretty clear that where somebody has control of funds, that person has the burden of proving that they weren't dissipated. So I do think that I would have to concede that the husband has the burden. However, the husband did produce over $88,000 in receipts for materials, and it was uncontradicted. I mean, it's hard to, how could the court say he hasn't satisfied me as to the amount?
Didn't the court along those lines?
The amount is zero. Yeah.
Along those lines, and that would be a credibility finding, didn't the court find that some of these receipts were for other projects, they predated this home, and didn't the court discredit the reliability of those receipts as being applied to this home project?
Well, I believe the court's actual statement was that it predated husband's purchase of the home, and I did answer that in the brief, where I discussed that this was an investment project between husband, wife, and Jack May, three co-investors. Well, Jack May was really the money investor. Husband was going to do the repairs. Wife was going to do the selling as the real estate agent. I don't think it would be unusual for repairs to start happening before husband bought the home much later. Husband bought the home from Jack May after it couldn't be sold.
Wasn't there evidence that would have supported a finding that wife, that he basically moved in and swooped in on a lien that she had undersold to May, and that he then acquired it in his own name? Wasn't there, and the court was clearly troubled about him playing fast and loose on this, by getting her out of a secured position that she may have given up too easily.
Well, it was May, actually, who purchased.
And then husband in turn took it over from May. Is that not right?
Well, that was much later, though. That was after they had made efforts. The home was actually on the market for quite some time. And so the court, you know, the court certainly can assign the entire value of the home to the husband, which is why we have to talk about what's the value of the home, which I'd like to get to. And the court can, you know, and in terms of dissipation, of course, we always have to distinguish between economic fault and, I don't know what you would call it, moral fault. And the cases are very, very clear that you can't find dissipation just because you don't like what somebody did.
Before we get to fault, let's talk about where the money went. 79, it's 204 total was allegedly
yes.
dissipated. 79 was just loan forgiveness. So how could that be dissipated? I mean, maybe it's better asking your opposing counsel, but can you dissipate a debt forgiveness? Is that possible to dissipate that?
I don't think so.
Okay.
I think again, that's why the value of the home is important, because that's incorporated is...
Well, you have two prongs, and I know you say that she got there inconsistently. One prong is to say the home was worth $520 at the time of the orders. The other is to say, alternatively, there was a $204 that husband received that he dissipated. So let's focus on the dissipation prong.
Okay.
And I guess the 79 question is better for your opponent. But the 125, what's the evidence in the record of what happened to the 125 that husband did receive, I guess, 125 in cash?
Well, I think there's no evidence as to where it went, and so you can't say that it was expended for illegitimate.
But I think you just conceded to Judge Bernard, it's your burden.
Right, and so that's why I'm not going there, but I did want to point that out.
Found simply on the dissipation prong that 125 is unaccounted for, it should have been marital property, we don't know what happened to it, it's husband's burden because husband was in possession of it, the court could, under your concession of Judge Bernard and burden of proof, say, therefore, I'm going to presume it's been dissipated?
Because it's not a matter of where it went. It's a matter of what it was for. If it's reimbursement for husband's repairs, that's a legitimate. Husband already expended the money, and he expended $88,000 in.
According to him, and she could discredit the reliability of those receipts and for a variety of reasons.
Well, but she discredited them for, I think, a reason that makes no sense.
That would be a clear error finding under that. That part of the component would be a clearly erroneous factual finding.
It would. And also I want to point out that many of the receipts were for after. As a matter of fact, I think all of them, or most of them, the vast majority, were for after the date that they began this scheme of trying to repair, remodel, and sell this home. And for the court just to simply make up a finding, basically, that even though you give me these receipts, I just think in my head that these are for other projects, even though I have no evidence before me at all that these are connected to other projects, would be clearly erroneous. I also think the court did not find that the husband didn't satisfy her as to the amount. That's not what the court said. The court basically said, if you read as a whole, the court was finding no repairs were made, that she discounted everything, and there was really no basis for doing that. I do want to talk very briefly about a value, because I think this is a real problem here. The court relied on an appraisal that wasn't in evidence. There was one appraisal in evidence. Dennis Rolker testified. His appraisal came into evidence. It was $335,000. The court in its order says, I'm discounting that because Chris Brudish, some guy, did this other appraisal, and it was for some different amount. The problem is Chris Brudish never testified at permanent orders hearing. He didn't testify at the contempt hearing. His appraisal was not entered at the permanent orders hearing. His appraisal wasn't entered at the contempt hearing. Basically, she just plucked it out of the file. I know what it was. It was an unadmitted exhibit from the contempt hearing.
We'll call Exhibit 9 in the contempt hearing?
Yeah, it was Exhibit 9. It was, I guess, the wife's Exhibit 9 from the contempt hearing. It was in this notebook. The notebook was sitting there in the court file. Judge Arkin didn't do the contempt hearing. The magistrate Gresh did. And she apparently just went to the file and plucked it out. But it was never admitted. And Chris Brudish never testified.
Was there anything in the record where the magistrate admitted all exhibits ahead of the hearing, or there was just no admission of them?
No, it simply was not admitted. I personally did the contempt hearing. I can tell you that we thought about what was going to be admitted. There was never a blanket admission as to all exhibits. So Exhibit 9, it just was never admitted. And so the basis on which she rejected Rolker's appraisal is, there's no evidence for it. It's also a violation of due process, because how could we have notice or an opportunity to respond to a court using an unadmitted exhibit? The other problem with the valuation, briefly, is that the court relied on loan value. And loan value is not the same as market value. Market value is how you value a marital property. What's it going to be worth to me if I get the house? It's going to be worth what I can sell it for. It's going to be worth what I can get loans on it for, because I have equity in it, which is all determined by market value. And the at least one case, the Lord case that I cited in the brief, says you have to use market value.
Could mortgage value or loan value be relevant in consideration of what the market value is?
I think the loan value could be relevant, but here it was the court's only basis. Basically, with the court added the loan value to the value of the repairs it says were never made to arrive at the at the home value. So we've got a real problem because the portion of the value attributed to the repairs can't be there if the repairs weren't made. And that leaves only the loan value. It's the sole basis for the valuation. And I think that was legal error. The court used an incorrect legal standard in valuing the home. So that is a significant problem. The loan just tells you really how much debt there is on the property. So it can be one piece of evidence, but by itself, all it tells you is how much debt there is. And I don't think it can be sufficient by itself. The only real evidence of market value is the Roelker appraisal that was rejected by the court on the basis of the unadmitted Brutish appraisal. I will attempt to address the contempt issues in the 50 seconds I have left. I'll try and reserve my remaining time if I might.
Certainly, of course.
Thank you.
May it please the court. My name is Brian DeBush. I've represented Ms. Siegfried on this case from just shortly after she filed the pro se petition requesting she be divorced from Mr. Siegfried. But as the court can see, this case had more evidence than 99% of the dissolution cases that ever come before this court. It was a tremendous evidentiary burden to go through the litigation in this case, and it's now been through the Court of Appeals now twice. I've been the counsel on this throughout, and this court can see in the record that Judge Arkin struggled tremendously with the number of issues in this case. She finally came down to the one solid issue she could distribute, which was what happened to the North 3rd Street property. It was supposed to be initially a joint investment of the marriage, but Mr. Siegfried eventually took that property over in his own name and then mortgaged the place to the hilt. So the question here, I think, and the question for Judge Arkin on remand was, why are you awarding Ms. Siegfried anything out of this house? And the answer is the $79,200 that Mr. Siegfried originally received from Mr. May as part of a second mortgage when he took the property over became cash in his pocket that we could never track. We didn't know where it went. The $125,000 that he later received in the form of two checks from Mr. May again disappeared, and we didn't know where it went.
Let me ask you about the first part of that, the $79,000.
Sure.
Is it clear that he received $79,000 distribution, or was that simply a paper debt that he was, did he ever receive that, or was that, I can't tell from the record. You've been with the case the whole time. Can you tell us where the did he ever got $79,000?
I did my best to try and explore that issue with him during his testimony and in discovery, and we never did find out what happened to the money from the second mortgage.
Not what happened. Do we know he received it?
We can't tell. It's impossible to tell. It looks like it's a second mortgage on top of his first, and it looks like he received a series of distributions from Mr. May, but the problem was, it's just like the problem with the receipts. Sure, there's $88,000 in receipts, but it's a dozen different credit cards and a number of different sources, and we could never tell where the money came from to pay for the receipts. It turned out some of them were Ms. Siegfried's own credit cards.
So let me ask another question, if I could. You've got two ways, or Judge Arkin at least tried to, on remand, satisfy the court-ordered findings in two ways. One is to say the value is 520, mm-hmm. and the other is to say, even if I don't count the 520, I find $204,000 was dissipated.
Yes.
Which one do you like better? We'll start out there. Or actually, don't you have to pick one, because they're inconsistent, it seems to me. But wouldn't you concede that there's at least tension between the two? Because the 520 came up with $125,000 repairs that, apart from the legal question that your opposing counsel raises about whether you can base value on loans, her findings was the 125, at least in part, was never put into the house.
I like the dissipation finding better.
You like that better? All right, good.
I can see the tension between the two. I don't think she was wrong necessarily on the second finding to say that the value of the home was something around $520,000, because that's what he received, he said, in loans, reimbursements, and money he then took from the reimbursements and put back into the property. That was his position. Mr.
Although your theory was that they were not arm's length transactions.
Oh, no, they definitely weren't.
Okay, so isn't that a problem, using appraisals and so-called loans and something that under your theory is not really arm's length? If you had a true lender, if you had Citibank, maybe not a good example, but an arm's length lender making a loan, that might be a little firmer footing rather than a long-term friend.
Okay. The long-term friend was the source of the original loans back when we filed this case in 03. But after that and during the pendency of the dissolution, he was able to remortgage and refinance the property at arm's length. So at the time of the contempt hearing, we had at least talked about the refinancing of the property just repeatedly, including Judge Arkin's order on remand indicating there was a further refinance after the permanent order for another amount that she didn't really count, didn't count against Mr. Siegfried, but it was just repeatedly remortgaged in arm's length transactions.
Well, ultimately, when the house was foreclosed, how much debt was owing on it by husband?
I'm afraid I don't know that figure. It was in excess of the $400,000. It was well in excess of $400,000. I think it was almost up to $475,000.
That's not what she relied on.
But she didn't rely on that because the foreclosure happened after permanent orders, obviously.
On that issue, Mr. DeBusch, if I may.
Sure.
The relevant period of time is at the time of the permanent orders here. Isn't that correct?
Seems so, yes.
If so, why do you think Judge Arkin looked at the brutish evaluation, considering that that was conducted after the permanent orders hearing? Isn't that an examination of evidence that's not relevant at all?
I guess the answer is I'm not sure on that. When she looked at the brutish appraisal and realized it had a much higher figure than Relker's, she discarded both. So I think she considered it, but only in relation to the earlier appraisal that was introduced to permanent orders, and then rejected them both based on their being so inconsistent. I don't think she's wrong to consider other evidence in either support or weakening of the original appraisal.
Mr. DeBusch, is that other appraisal evidence that may be considered, do you agree it was not admitted into evidence?
Frankly, I thought it had been admitted at the contempt hearing. It was an appraisal that
That's contempt hearing, but we're talking permanent orders, I think.
Oh, it was never admitted to permanent orders, I can tell you, because it posted permanent orders. The brutish appraisal came in later.
And this finding has to stand on based on evidence that was admitted in permanent orders, right? You can't bootstrap the they're two separate proceedings, aren't they?
They are two separate proceedings. Is the court asking specifically about the evidence admitted at the time of the contempt hearing as being irrelevant to what she would do on remand?
No, I guess, as I understood Judge Lichtenstein's question, or at least as I would interpret it, I would say that the relevant question is brutish admissible evidence at the permanent orders hearing, because to justify valuation, I think you have to rely on evidence that was admitted at permanent orders. You can't talk about something that was admitted 2 years later in a different hearing involving contempt of the husband.
The question. I'm not sure how to formulate the answer, to tell you the truth, because when Judge Arkin receives the remand order from this court and has to consider what she has in evidence in the file at that point, and I'm not sure. The information in the court file, I think, becomes judicially noticed either exhibits and information or facts that other courts can rely upon when reviewing the file.
Well, for a variety of purposes, I assume that is so. But the purpose we're talking here is the valuation of an asset to determine what wife was entitled to out of that asset. And I think our law is pretty clear, isn't it, that we look, the point in time we look at is the date of the permanent orders hearing. And thus, anything that occurs afterwards, if you've got authority, please tell me. Is there authority that says things that occur afterwards can be considered? Because hypothetically, let's assume for the purposes of argument that we reverse and remand again. Okay?
Okay.
For this purpose.
Just to exclude that evidence?
Yes.
And go back only to the evidence?
Hypothetically, yes, to go back to the evidence that was available at the time. Wouldn't that be a proper resolution? And if not, why not?
I can think of this in two ways, I guess. The first is whether or not she can appropriately discard both appraisals if she thinks they vary too much from each other and not use either as direct evidence of value. That's what I think she did. I think that's different than, say, admitting the Brutish appraisal and saying the property is worth $420,000 because this guy, after permanent order, said so. I think that would require some kind of hearing or explanation to respondent, obviously, and ask him why they should not use that second appraisal. And then what we'd end up with is some kind of hearing talking about that further evidence. It wouldn't appear to be relevant because it postdates the permanent orders by, you know, a significant period of time. So that's the first response. The second response I think I have is, at the time she reviews the court file and discovers new exhibits and information and testimony within the file, is she required to exclude all of those things in her evaluating the value of the property? I guess on that I'm really not sure. If the information is admitted at later hearings, I'm just not sure how to answer that. I'm sorry. Does the panel have any other questions of me? In terms of the other issues mentioned, I guess what I wanted to point out to the panel was that the issues sort of come down to you know, six of one, half a dozen of the other. I think what the court was doing in its remand order was saying, if I look at the value and I award to Mr. Siegfried the value of the property, it's valued at some amount. Maybe it's 520. Maybe it's underneath that. Maybe it's some value. But if he's mortgaged that property and taken all of the money out of it, the court felt that because the money taken out of the property hadn't been devoted to any marital purpose whatsoever that she could tell, she had to do something with all of that. At the end of the calculations on this, the math just worked out incredibly in Mr. Siegfried's favor and not at all in favor of Ms. Siegfried.
But is that the test? Isn't dissipation required pursuant to the first panel's first division's order? I mean, you have to find dissipation, and I'm just having trouble when you say, as a 79, you don't know where it went. The 125, you don't know what happened to it. I'm having trouble to say that the court could properly make a finding of dissipation based on the absence of evidence about what happened with the money. Isn't it, don't you have to find that it was used for this purpose and that constituted dissipation of marital property?
I think the finding is that it has been not devoted to a marital purpose. And we couldn't find that. I mean, there was no evidence as to what happened to the money. We couldn't even find the account it went into.
I guess that's the question. If there's no evidence about what happened to the money, I don't know how you can say it was dissipated. Wouldn't you have to first know what happened to the money?
Well, we know that it went to Mr. Siegfried because he admitted he received the money.
But he says he spent it for purposes related to the house.
Sure.
And you can say, I don't buy that, but I guess it seems the next step is, well, what do you believe happened to it? Or I don't know, it just seems to be
It's really impossible to tell. And if you look at all of the exhibits, you'll see a number of real estate transactions that Mr. Siegfried was involved in. He was remodeling houses all the way out to Vail, all the way down south of Castle Rock. And we couldn't tell, I mean, the money was being shuffled back and forth between so many companies, we couldn't tell where things were going. And when it came to these big deposits, we really didn't know where those went. I mean, he, and that was the same with a lot of the real estate transactions. We couldn't tell who got the actual cash. And so when I would ask him over and over again, and this is part of the reason why he was found incredible as a matter of law, was because he offered explanations that varied from hearing to hearing sometimes. And we without being able to tell where the money went, because we knew it went at least into his pocket, he was responsible really for explaining at that point, what did you do with the money and show us how you devoted it to any marital purpose whatsoever. And what it looks like he did was he paid, you know, his company debts off, and he devoted it to his repaying his friends maybe or investing in other real estate projects, but we really couldn't tell what happened to that money. It was the same problem with the Hudson project that he had invested in prior to the marriage and that he said was someday going to pay off for Mrs. Siegfried. This really was a major problem with our presentation of evidence, because we had no idea what happened with that project, and it was millions of dollars that he had access to, but we couldn't tell what happened to a lot of it.
I'm sorry to interrupt you, but you were talking about money that he had pocketed and you have no idea where it went. I have a question about the $316,000, the mortgage with Cherry Creek.
Right.
Was that money that he pocketed or was that a debt?
That looked to be a debt because originally the house had been purchased by Mr. May for $125,000. He was able to redeem that top lien position and take the property. When Mr. Siegfried then took the property over, 316 became in part the $79,200 that Mr. Siegfried took. So part of that money was $79,000 that he was able to take out as cash. The rest of it was supposed to be payable to Mr. May. It was supposed to be reduced to debts to Mr. May to buy the property. And Mr. Siegfried explained that he was taking that over to, you know, support his business partner and longtime friend and make sure he got his money back out of it as quickly as possible. So that part, as far as I know, those debts became Mr. Siegfried's to pay Mr. May. But the difference between the $125,000 and the $316,000 that the property was actually mortgaged for, I don't know why there was so much more at the time the property was purchased by Mr. Siegfried, because Mr. Siegfried had done at that point, he said, some of the work for Mr. May had been reimbursed for some of the materials he had put into the home. That's what he said. Then when he bought the property, it was almost three times, you know, 2.5 times what it was originally purchased for, and we couldn't determine why the purchase price was so much in excess of what Mr. May had paid for it. I mean, granted, maybe the property's in bad condition, but at the time you've put in what he said was thousands of dollars in work and materials, you would think you'd have something to show for it. What we wanted was just a table. Here's what I spent this month to fix the property. But he didn't have a permit. He didn't have diagrams or plans. He had lots of receipts, but we couldn't tell how those receipts related to what's inside the house.
I mean, Mr.
Oh, sorry.
It's on.
Thank you.
About 45 seconds. Pardon me. My mistake. 45 seconds, Mr. Swivel. My two colleagues would beat me if I were.
Thank you, Your Honor. With regard to the Brutish appraisal, the simple answer is this. The question is the value of the home at the time of the decree. And so the Brutish appraisal, it was unadmitted, but also it came after the time of the decree, and so its value simply isn't relevant. The $79,000, not cash. It's a second mortgage. The second mortgage instrument was in evidence at the permanent orders hearing, no evidence otherwise. With regard to the repairs, the court has to value all marital property. The court can't decide just not to value something. And so if some repairs were made, the court has to make every effort to try and value that and not just say, I agree that some repairs were made, but I'm just not going to assign it any value. I'm just going to make Mr. Siegfried pay for it. Thank you.
Counsel, thank you very much for your arguments today. We appreciate them. The case